What up? It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. My guest today is the head coach of the Atlanta Hawks. He's also the former backcourt partner of the new Brooklyn Nets coach. Most importantly, he's the pride of San Jose's Eastside Union High School District, where he is a Hall of Famer. I try not to let that intimidate me. He's also the world's biggest round table pizza fan. Lloyd Pierce, LP, how are you, sir?
Yeah, Howard, how you doing?
Good.
Hell of an intro.
I think I just set a new record for lengthiest intro. How about that?
Good.
But all of it appropriate. I think our buddy Mark Spears, our fellow San Josean, I never know sure how to do it, San Josean, has written about your roundtable pizza fascination or passion. So I had to at least throw that in there because we had this out on Twitter.
It's definitely real. I think there's a lot of people that just don't know about roundtable in general. So I try and be the public spokesperson for it.
They seem to appreciate it because when we had this argument on Twitter in which I caped for straw hat pizza, which I assume is long gone, you and roundtable came back strong. So yeah. If you threw the pin in Google Maps for you right now in suburban Atlanta and tried to find the nearest roundtable, how many miles away?
There is none.
Like, but it's not even like there's not even any in the southeast.
No, I think the nearest, I think there may be one in Arizona. I want to say, I know there's some in Vegas and then all of California. There's I know just based on the travel. So when we play Vegas Summer League, when we play in Portland, I can get it in Portland.
Yeah.
And then San Francisco and Sacramento are the trips that I get round table pizza throughout the year.
It's like a set appointment. You know you're going the second you land. It's
right.
it's like everybody else when they get to LA or Vegas, they go straight to In-N-Out Burger, especially the California natives. But you're going straight for the round table.
I go round table.
I respect the commitment. I do.
Yep.
Real quick, before I wanted to talk about obviously your former backcourt partner from college, Steve Nash, the most surprising, stunning news of the week, amazing and really intriguing. I want to obviously immediately thought about you and wanted to reach out, learn a little bit more about what Steve Nash will bring to the table for the Nets. But before we get to that, I'm sure you've been glued to the TV as the rest of us are watching the playoffs in the bubble. How has it been for you? I mean, obviously it's the playoffs now. Unfortunately, the Hawks would have been out anyway. But just was there a sense of FOMO of missing out just during the bubble games, the restart regular season? How has it been just to kind of be this detached for this long?
Yeah, I mean it's frustrating when you think of the totality of your seasons and how you try and add them up. And so for me, in our situation here in Atlanta, you know, everything ties into the plan. And, you know, we're on a plan where experience is our greatest teacher for our guys. You know, being relatively inexperienced in terms of their NBA games, you know, Trey has played two seasons and he's already an all-star. Just imagine if we had more games for him, what his growth would look like. And so that's the part that's toughest is seeing our guys continue to grow. And the thing about Orlando, they've created this atmosphere that really of any team, we would have really benefited from the team bonding, no distractions, the ability to connect and practice, and that being the central focus. And then to play the games where there's just tremendous meaning behind every game, whether we're in the seeding games or in the playoff games. And so all of the factors that, you know, make it tough also make it what we were looking for. We're looking for that type of experience. We need that type of experience. And that's where the FOMO is. I wish we were there so our guys could compete and play for something similar to what Phoenix went through, but also bond and really come together. You know, one of the things I've had my video guy clip is, you know, all the quotes and sayings and statements that players have made about enjoying being with each other, enjoying working with each other, enjoying the non-distraction, the non-travel, and being able to focus on basketball, because I think it's really benefited those teams that have been there, that are there.
And I was skeptical, honestly, about the league bringing any teams other than the teams that would have been the playoff teams as of March 11th, right? Like the top 16 at that time, or the top eight in each conference. But the Suns are really the example of why it was valuable, right? Like you nailed it. Like it's that was huge for a young team. And your team, obviously, even younger and even more in need of all that. So the league has set it up for teams that were outside the bubble to have some sort of team workouts starting September 21st. So it's a few weeks out and through October 6th. I assume you guys are in the midst of planning for all of that and have something set up. Like, can you give me some sense of what that will look like?
We're planning now. You know, what we have to do is similar to what some of the teams had to do going to Orlando. We'll have a week here in Atlanta starting the 14th, where we have to get tested every day, which will require all of our players to be here to get the full 7 days of testing before we go to the hotel. Once we get to the hotel, we're treating it as a mini camp. And in my imagination, it's going to be very much similar to what NFL does. You know, they have these off-season mini camps where the guys come back into town. They're able to, you know, work on their system, work on their conditioning, work on their timing. You know, we will get to play, which is really most important for us. But we're also going to get to work. And because we're going to be in the hotels, there's a few excursions that we'll do. We'll obviously watch some playoff basketball, and we'll try and do some team activity as well. Nothing crazy, nothing bizarre. Really just try and occupy the time the best way that we can and still get some competitive basketball in. So we have 2 weeks once we get in the hotel. We have a week prior. We'll end up with three really good weeks of team bonding and collectiveness.
It feels critical for the eight teams that didn't go, right? I know how, you know, that the idea of 9 months off for these teams just seemed to be incredibly detrimental, you know, to the rest of you. So I'm glad the league set this up. I'm glad you guys are getting that opportunity. We still, of course, don't know when next season will start. And so there's still just that mystery. It's tough. What else have you done just to keep your guys engaged from a distance?
Well, our guys have been good. You know, we open up our gym May 8th. It was Monday, May 8th, and, you know, it's only 40 minutes, 45 minutes or 30 minutes, whatever the number was, that players were able to get on the court. And our guys basically have been doing that since, doing the individual work. It was one player, one coach, and then it went from one player, two coaches. And then we were able to increase the amount of players in the facility at the same time. And then we were able to introduce the weight room. And our guys have taken full advantage of that. Obviously, some leave and are out of town. Trey has spent some time in L.A. Clint has spent some time in Houston. Kevin had spent some time in New York. But they've all been here and through Atlanta as well. And, you know, we've had great opportunities to really connect. And, you know, similar to what we do in an off season, where it's just focused on development and we're able to touch the guys and work on a strength program. It's just been a lot longer than we all wanted. And, you know, normally in this case, a lot of our younger guys would be playing summer league or going elsewhere to play. You know, that's the other opportunity that's been taken away from us. But we've been able to try and maximize what we have, which isn't much, but we've tried to maximize it.
Last quick Hawks question here. I know this is really a Travis Schlenk question, but you guys end up with the 6th pick after the lottery. I feel like the last thing that you guys need right now is another 19-year-old trying to find his way in the world.
Right.
Given all the challenges of a really young roster, I imagine you've probably had some animated discussions about what to do with that pick and whether or not you really want to use that versus trade it.
No, I mean, you know, the beauty of the relationship I have with Travis is I'm not knocking on his door saying, you know, what the hell am I going to do with a 19-year-old? I think we all kind of understand if you can add value in a pick and here's a young guy that can come in and really be a part of our future, that's great. But our present really is going to be focused on making a next step. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to be the greatest team next year in the league. I have talked about us being a playoff caliber team. I think we have the ability to make that jump. That jump is going to require our young guys to be together, for one, which will be the first start, is just having those guys, those five or six guys, introducing Clint Capella to the roster and seeing how he meshes and gels with our guys, and then being able to get a couple free agents that can come in and contribute right away. So that pick has a lot of value, you know, but that player is going to have to be able to catch up to where we're headed, not necessarily be thrown into the fire the way Trey and Cam and Kevin Herter were in their first years.
We'll be back with more in a minute with Lloyd Pierce. Let's talk about your former backcourt mate from Santa Clara University, Steve Nash. This was by far the most surprising news of the week. And kudos to the Nets and to Steve Nash for somehow keeping this below the radar as long as they did, up until the time he was actually announced as coach, basically, within minutes. You know him as well as anybody. I think the story was 1993, before you went to Santa Clara. He was part of a recruiting pitch to you. And you spent 2 years playing together in college. What do you know of Steve Nash that will inform how he might carry himself as a head coach?
Well, it's the same that everybody else knows. You know, he's carried himself tremendously throughout his career. There's nothing I can share that's going to make Steve seem or look differently than what we all know of Steve. He's been a public figure for a long time, and he's carried himself consistently in that light. He's an ultimate teammate. He's been a true professional. He's really been diligent in how he's approached the game in terms of improvement, in terms of playing at the highest level, leading the league in offensive rating for 9 straight seasons when he was in Phoenix. One of the most unique styles that we've seen, really a trendsetter for the way the game is played right now with the pace and the space. And so, you know, it's been documented many times before about his humility as a teammate, as a person. And all you have to do is just watch him in an interview and you can understand, what a great guy. What an unbelievable person. His passion for others, his passion for the game, his passion for things that matter. We've seen him speak up during this time on racial injustice. None of that's going to change because he's a head coach. If anything, you know, some of us, like myself included, you know, we were granted this opportunity, and it's been like a wow moment for him. It's just, you know, how can I help? You know, he's new to the profession, but he's built for the profession in a lot of ways.
Did you see some of that even early on, Lloyd? I mean, just as, you know, as a teammate of his at Santa Clara, the way that, you know, you guys made an early connection, or the way that he even interacted with teammates as a college player, were there elements there that you could see early on? I mean, we know, yes, he was a great leader with the Suns, especially those years. He certainly is a selfless player. And those characteristics, I would think, bode well in coaching too. But can you zone in on a couple of those elements that you could have seen early on?
I think Isaiah Thomas talked about it the other day. He's a point guard that really had to lead. And, you know, he wasn't a score first point guard. And I don't even know if you'd say he was a pass first point guard. He just knew how to lead the team. And that's a really strong characteristic, because it puts his involvement and understanding the game and then trying to position some of us as teammates. Now, we were very much system oriented. We ran the flex offense back then, and it wasn't as much a pick and roll game that you see and you saw him play in the NBA, but he's always had that ability to lead. You know, if you ask any of my teammates, none of them would have thought that I was going to be a coach. I was a quiet guy on the team, especially in those first couple of years. But he wasn't, you know, by the time I met him, he was extremely vocal and extremely engaged. He was playing Canadian basketball in the summer. So he had a different role and he had a different presence on our team. So you can easily implement the fact that what he has always done was going to translate into coaching at some point. It was just a matter of whether or not he wanted to get involved in coaching.
Did you see this coming at all?
You know, I thought about it, not so much in this opportunity. I always thought about it, you know, when Phoenix opened up a few times. I thought that would have been the landing spot. And when he had no interest then, you know, I really didn't think that there was much interest for him. I do know that he's been with the Warriors as a consultant, and he spent a lot of time in the summers working out with guys. So that's kept him connected to the game and working out with players. But I didn't know. I didn't have any insight on him getting this job or being pursued for this job.
Yeah. I mean, just more in general, did you think, you know, was it inevitable at some point this was going to be his way of plugging back into the game in a full time?
Yeah. I just always, you know, there's some guys that you say, man, he would really be a really good coach. I think he would be able to contribute to the game from the sidelines because of how he mentally approached the game. I think he's one of those guys. I think there are a lot of guys, former players, especially, that you can pinpoint, you know, guys such as myself, I'm not a former player. No one can say, hey, he's always done this. And so I have to approach it a different way. It's the work ethic. It's the experience from the work ethic. It's being put in positions to advance, where you can look at a Jason Kidd, you can look at a Steve Nash, you can look at a Sam Cassell, you can look at a Derek Fisher, you know, and I'm just really focusing on former great point guards that have played in this league, that have coached. You know, Sam has been coaching for a long time, but those other three guys, you know, basically jumped into the league similar to what Steve has, but you almost see that being a natural transition for them as well.
Yeah. So you've been at this a couple of years now. I mean, obviously you've been at this for a long time in the league, 11 years as an assistant, before becoming head coach of the Hawks, but you've made that transition. He's skipping that step, of course. And look, we've seen other guys do it, and it can work out well. It can work out not so well. We've seen every outcome. Knowing what you know, having gone through the years as an assistant and then making the transition to head coach, maybe Steve has already made this phone call to you, but if he makes the call that says, you know, that's looking for your advice as somebody who is taken on that role, you've had a couple of years to settle in and figure out what works for you, what doesn't, what would you tell him?
Well, I think every situation is extremely unique, and he's walking into either a home run or an explosion. He's got aspirations, and that team and that organization, they have the capability, they have the roster, they have aspirations of championship and probably nothing less. And so that's unique, because that there aren't a lot of teams that you're going to say, 2021, here are your six, you know, candidates for a realistic, legit shot at winning the championship. Brooklyn is probably in that with the healthy Kyrie, healthy KD, and you just keep going down the line. I mean, I don't know who their third option is, because they've got some pretty good players. He's got an opportunity that's really unique because of, you know, what he's walking into. And so for him, you know, I think it's being really diligent and really patient with, you know, what he thinks he's going to need in terms of staff. I believe Jacques Vaughn is staying on, and there's some experience that's there. But who's going to do the game plans? Who are going to do the game plans? Who's going to do a lot of the scouting? You know, which player development coaches are going to be able to engage with those players? Because, you know, as great of a relationship guy that Nash is, he now has to manage 17 guys when you think of the two ways and his staff. He's not going to be on the court with his top player every single day and pregame. And so he's got to find staff that is capable of working with those guys. And when things aren't great, capable of holding those guys accountable and having the conversations. And that's an important part. Now, he's also got to figure out, you know, the culture, what type of culture he wants to have there. And that's where the staff comes into play as well. In addition to, you know, does he need to shift from the previous culture? Does he need to create his own? Does he kind of blend the two? And some experience within the organization that's still there can help him there. But, you know, his situation is different. You know, he doesn't have to, you know, as a new coach, he doesn't have to learn the league. He knows the league. He's played in the league. He knows coverages. He knows concepts. He knows schemes. He needs to learn his team and figure out what works best for them. And that's where the assistants, and that's where his video watching and his time commitment will come into play. But, you know, for me, like when I was an assistant, it took me a couple of years just to learn how to navigate through working out with players. You know, what do you really focus on? The dynamic of the relationships. And then you go into scouting and game preps and being able to lead a meeting and lead a walkthrough and things of that nature. And those those things aren't easy. People think they have the answers, we'll try and present it to a bunch of players and make sure you know exactly what you're talking about. And that's from film study. And so there's a lot of components that will come into play, but he's also learning how to delegate, how to manage, how to separate himself from being the workout guy to the head coach. Those are the things that are going to be a little bit different in the first couple months as he's navigating through this. But he's got time. This is the beauty of it. It's September. We don't know when the season's starting. He's got time to really connect with the staff, connect on what they did last year. He's obviously connected with a lot of players because they have mutual and a lot of admiration for him. But he's got time.
It's interesting, Lloyd, listening to you rattle off like all these different duties of the head coach. I remember when Brian Shaw first got the job in Denver, and he had been an assistant with the Lakers and with the Pacers and everything. And I was asking him what was the difference. And he listed a lot of those things. Like, people think, well, the head coach, okay, they drop some plays, they run the practice, whatever, and that's it. Roll the balls out and players do the rest. But the number of administrative things you guys have to do, the laundry list of duties that go far beyond the court, there's a lot to it. And it's organizational and it's communication skills. It's everything else. As you've, you know, moved through the league with multiple teams, assistant, head coach, I mean, break it down for listeners who may not understand this, because schematics, X's and O's, playbook, like, obviously that's important, but the communication skills, the ability to connect with your players, the concept of buy-in from the outside, I would guess this, like, you could be average on X's and O's, but if you were an A-plus in communication and the ability to get buy-in and engaging and having your players trust, like, I think that probably goes farther than whatever the best playbook in the world is. And I feel like what Steve might come to this with is that, in addition to obviously being really smart about the game, and we saw that in his own game, he is somebody who's always had that, been able to easily connect with people. And I feel like that's going to be maybe his greatest asset going in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a loaded question. there's so many components of it. You know, buy-in is an absolute. You have to have buy-in. You know what? In a lot of ways, it doesn't matter what scheme or coverage or play you run. If you don't have buy-in and the guys are halfway doing it, then that's half the issue. And so then you say, well, success is what's important and it matters. You know, how do you get buy-in? Well, you have to win. You got to win some games, and the guys need to trust that, all right, well, this is working. You know, you can be a great guy with a lot of buy-in and no success, and eventually you're not that great a guy, and you really don't have that much buy-in. I think that's just kind of the trickle-down effect of it. But the biggest thing you mentioned, and John Lucas said this a long time ago, we were working a camp together. He said, you know, everybody thought I was a great coach and I had all these great plays, and then I went and got a different job. I took those same great plays and I was that same great coach and they just didn't work. And all of a sudden they said, I need to get some new plays. And, you know, it isn't the plays. It isn't the schemes. You know, I worked in Cleveland and I worked in Memphis, and in both teams, we were top two, top three defensively. And we did it different, completely different ways. In Cleveland, we were a hedge team. We sent the ball to the middle of the floor and we were able to rotate. In Memphis, we pushed everything on the sidelines. We never rotated. We called it stunt and recover. We never wanted to be in rotations. Mike Conley, Tony Allen, Marc Gasol was always in position. That's when Marc Gasol was Defensive Player of the Year. We were a great positional team, and then everybody did their job. Top two, top three defensively on both teams, and did it completely different ways. And so it's just a matter of what you do, what you put in. You try and do it as best you can. You have to have buy-in. You have to be able to communicate and articulate it. And the players have to have some respect for, you know, who they're playing with, but also who's leading them. And, you know, that's important. The other side that's really important is, and this is what I'm going through as a first-time head coach, is really elevating my staff. You know, the staff are the ones who do a lot of the work. They're scouting the opponents. They're providing the game plan. They're delivering the walkthrough. Someone's focusing on offense, someone's focusing on defense, and I get to jump in and do, you know, kind of anything. I can say I'm running the walkthrough today, or I'm doing the script session today. But that's important that they have buy-in as well. And so we have to be on the same page, and that's why it's important to organize a meeting to get everybody on the same page, so you're speaking the same language. When the game starts, one coach says, hey, send it middle. The other coach says, no, don't let them go middle. You got two different coaches saying two different things, and that's how you lose credibility.
So from what you know of Steve, where will he check the boxes right off the bat going in? What do you think is going to be the areas where, let's face it, he was never an assistant. He was in this league at a high level, two-time MVP, but there are a lot of things you learned along the way that he does not have the benefit of in terms of being on a staff. So we know he's a great communicator. We know he's a great guy. We know he's smart about the game. What is he going to have to figure out on the fly?
Well, I think the biggest thing is really trying to figure out his top two guys. And we all from the outside can understand that. Again, his situation is so unique. He doesn't have to input this extremely complex offensive system that says we need to do this and this. And now he needs to create some standards and he needs to create some concepts offensively. And I'm just speaking on the offensive side right now, because I think it'll make more sense. He needs to create some standards and some concepts that the entire team can say, hey, this is what we're going to hang our hat on. But he also needs to back up and just say, I got two really special players and I'm going to let them do their thing. Similar to how he played, you know, Mike gave him the basketball in Phoenix and the guys knew to run to the corners. They knew in pick and rolls to put your hand out. They with pick and pop guys, they knew how to space the floor appropriately. And Steve got to orchestrate that offense tremendously. I think he understands that. I think he gets that. And I think he understands who he has on that roster as well. So very unique situation. It's hard to say, hey, he's got to have all of these things in play. You know, for me here, I'm creating a culture. I'm creating an identity. We're still bringing in talent. And, you know, the beauty of it is Trey has really established and separated himself. And he's the guy that's going to be able to do more. And really doing more is how can he help make the job easier for a lot of other players? And how can I let him? How can I allow him to do that? So it's great because I'm getting to see his development take off to where he can be one of those guys similar to what Nash has and two of those guys right now, really more if you look at, you know, Dinwiddie and you look at LeVert and other guys. But part of his job will be able to just say, I don't need to do more. I need to do less and let these guys be who they are.
Okay, there's more Full 48 with Lloyd Pierce, so stick around. So there was some backlash to this, and it was understandable yesterday. The Brooklyn Nets job was certainly one of the best openings, if not maybe the most attractive opening in the league because of the guys they have, because of Durant and Kyrie, because of their ability to be contenders on day one. And I'm just curious your perspective on this, Lloyd. You obviously came up as somebody who didn't play in the league, who had to pay your dues first at Santa Clara as an assistant, and then with four different teams in the NBA to finally get your opportunity. And, you know, there's a sensitivity here and an understandable one. There have been a paltry number of black head coaches in this league in recent years. I've written about this, you know, several years ago, and it has not improved. If anything, it's maybe gotten worse. There are only five right now, including yourself, with four openings. So that number could still go up, we should note. But Steve, as much as he's accomplished in this league, gets to, you know, as people said yesterday, skip the line. I imagine you're sensitive to this on multiple levels, right? On the one hand, you're very close to Steve and you know what he's capable of and are excited for him as a friend. On the other hand, you're a black head coach in this league who had to come up a different way. And it's, you know, for all the black coaches in this league who are still waiting for that opportunity, I totally get it. And I've had these conversations with guys in the past. Where's the balance for you, and how did you see this if you can take the personal part out of it? And I know it's hard, you know, as a friend, but is the backlash and the concern fair?
Yes, on everything. I think Steve was able to advance because he's Steve Nash, and personally, I'm ecstatic. I'm excited for him. I think natural. I think he's truly an exception, and I'm extremely excited for him. And I think anyone, you know, had he retired last year, anyone would have said the same thing. You know, Steve wants to coach; he can get any job. I think you just put it together. You look at it that way. And so I'm going to talk about my situation because, as you mentioned, I was an assistant coach for 11 years, and I just completed my second year as a head coach. So I've only done 13 years in this league. And in a lot of ways, I've bypassed a lot of people. And I want to be very candid and upfront about that. Because I think when you look at my situation, you say, well, my situation was very much tailor-made to who I am and where I am in my career and what I've been through. My experience led me directly to Atlanta. It wouldn't have landed me in Brooklyn at any point in that situation. But my experience as being focused on player development early in my career, being able to run a defense in Philadelphia and go through a culture shift for 5 years, that tied into what we were doing here in Atlanta. We're going to draft 6 players in the last 2 drafts, and we're going to have a ton of cap space. And so we need to build a culture and develop some players. And that type of coach needs to understand that and be experienced in that. And so I was able to bypass people with more experience in this profession, black and white. And I know for sure that when I was hired, I'm sure there were a ton of backlash on, you know, how does LP get this job when there's other guys that have been interviewed for other jobs, had the experience, have been in the league longer. So I get that. And I understand that. I think the biggest dynamic and the biggest issue when we speak about African-American coaches and getting their opportunity, and there's just no structure. There's no system in place that's ever going to make this a really truly equitable opportunity for coaches that have put in their time, that have earned the respect. And that's what's frustrating, because it ultimately comes back to the relationship side. Travis and I worked together in Golden State, very short stint, but we worked together. He knows what I'm about. He knew what I was about. He was able to follow my career. Obviously, Nash and Marks played together. And so the relationship ends up being the number one criteria. You know, how well do you know the guy? How well are you connected? How much do you trust the coach to come in and really, you know, be your example of leading in this job? And then the second thing does, you know, it comes down to a lot of our assistant coaches and guys that are waiting for opportunities, you know, the work that they've put in. This is why a lot of guys like Jamal Mosley and Dave Vanderpool are constantly getting the interview. But I think that's the second criteria right now. And unfortunately, you know, as much work as they've put in, until there's a different system in play to hire coaches, I think that's going to be the second criteria, whereas relationships are always going to be the first. And this is where we're not seeing as much representation for African-American coaches getting the opportunity. And then you have to shift into, you know, the management side. There's only 3 or 4 GMs that are African-American. And so it's low representation on the coaches. It's low representation on the management. It's low representation on the ownership. And it's still going to be focused on relationships when these jobs are driven. And right now, and for a long time, African-Americans aren't getting the same opportunities to get the job. That's really what, for me, it comes down to. It isn't, you know, I'm not saying every African-American coach should get a job because we're better than anyone else. It's just more about, are we getting the opportunities to get the job, and what is the criteria? And I always look at my situation. I knew what the criteria was, and I know why I had a leg up in some cases, but you know, I know I'm not getting a lot of the other jobs at that time if it were on different aspects of what the job required, because that wasn't my expertise and I wasn't the most qualified candidate for that either.
It's tough, LP, when we look at this to judge any one team, right? You know, that collectively the NBA has not done a great job, you could say, on both levels that you mentioned, as head of basketball operations, whether it's team president or GM, and every team does it a little different, or whether it's with head coaches. You know, the Nets have been fine. I mean, look, before Kenny Atkinson, their last 3 head coaches were all African American, and 4 of their last 6. And obviously, they had one of the few black GMs in Billy King before he was replaced by Sean Marks. So the Nets in the last, you know, 10, 15 years or whatever, I think have been fine. But you can go team by team, and maybe some have better track records than others or worse track records than others. But I think you mentioned the key word, which is structure, that there is no reliable path necessarily. And especially now when teams have been going all kinds of unconventional routes to hire head coaches, and the relationships that you mentioned, that was a key thing that I mentioned in the story I wrote in 2015 about this issue, which was that oftentimes GMs and owners are going with somebody they already knew.
Howard, it's the same. When I got the job, you know, Travis and I spoke and we were speaking about staff and ideas of who to hire. But I had a lot of, you know, say and a lot of leeway. You know, I try to collaborate as much as I can. And Travis really said, hey, you know, go after who you would like to go after. I'm going to go after primarily who I trust, you know, who I've seen work my way up. But the first factor in that, you know, it is guys that I know are capable, have credibility, are going to work, are good at their job. The first factor for me was relationship. You know, who do I know? Who am I going to trust in this situation to show up, to work, And so it's the same until that criteria changes. You know, there needs to be a shift in who's in position to make these decisions. And then, you know, what type of network do they have? And so I'm not a big network guy. I'm not out there selling myself, trying to get jobs. And, you know, I need to meet this guy because he may be able to hire me in 10 years. That's not how I approach it. But I think it is an understanding that relationships in this business are extremely important.
No question.
It sucks because I want to see some of my buddies get opportunities. There aren't a whole lot of opportunity. Let's start there. But it ultimately comes down to the relationships and the guys. And I always said it, you still have to do your job. You still have to be really diligent. You have to be really excellent as an assistant, because when you get this opportunity, and this is the next factor, when you get this opportunity, make sure you take full advantage of it so that you are the new representation of, you know, me being a first-time head coach. I hope I really succeed. And for success, it really looks like I hope I am able to be here for a long time. I hope we are able to continually get better. I hope we become a great free agent destination because of the culture and because of the work we put in. If I do that part of my job, I create a new model of what that looks like, similar to what Eric Spoelstra has done. You know, he's that former video guy that worked his way up and has been there. He's our second longest tenured coach. So I have to do that as well and say, hey, if you give a guy an opportunity and you let him grow, here's what it could look like. This is why guys should get the opportunity. So I hold my responsibility very seriously. I'm very passionate on and off the court about helping this organization grow, helping our players grow. I'm very competitive. I want us to get better. I want us to make the appropriate step next year. And I want to be able to have the opportunity to see it through, not only for myself selfishly, but for other guys in this position to get this opportunity.
No question. And I know you need to go in a couple minutes here. I know you got some daddy duties I got to let you get to. So I'll just a couple more before I let you go. So Steve Nash is not the first to, quote unquote, skip the line like this, right? Like Doc Rivers did it when he went from the broadcast booth to Orlando Magic 20 years ago. Steve Kerr, of course, Mark Jackson, Derek Fisher, and Jason Kidd. You mentioned both of them. And in Fish and Kidd's case, they both went straight from, they pulled off their jersey, basically went straight to coaching. So it wasn't even just, they didn't even have distance from the league. Larry Bird, Isaiah Thomas, most of the guys I just mentioned had pretty good success. A couple exceptions in there. I don't want to pick on anybody. So it can go either way. And we've seen, you mentioned it, you know, Eric Spoelstra comes up the video, film guy route. There have been any number of different paths to get to this job. And, you know, it ruffles feathers in this case because Steve Nash, you know, for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that Jacques Vaughn had done a pretty good job as interim. And so immediately the race element comes in. So it ruffles people and I get it. I think there's a bigger picture and I think there's a lot of different factors that kind of are counterbalancing here. I think it's tough to deal with. And I think, as I parsed through my own feelings about this yesterday, I did have some conflicting feelings on it. Cause I do think the NBA needs to address this and hasn't done a good enough job. On the other hand, who's going to argue with the fact that Steve Nash is a two-time MVP and the kind of player and person he is, that he fits? And if Kevin Durant, and we don't know for sure, if Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and Durant having his relationship with Steve factored into this, that makes sense. As you pointed out, Lloyd, it's relationships in both directions, right? Up and down. Right. So up to the GM, down to the players. Ultimately, I guess his performance will justify whether or not this was the right move.
Well, it's important. And, you know, the vertical alignment with the players, coaches, general manager, ownership, if you have that kind of relationship alignment with the players saying the same thing that the GM is saying and the owner is on board, then that's really, it's a hell of a starting point. I think everyone's striving to be on the same page. But, you know, I still think this situation, it's unfortunate because it's a personal one with Nash. This situation of African-American black coaches, the representation in a league that's 80% African-American for the players, but not 80% in terms of coaching. And that's all across the board or in the general manager positions and decision-making positions. There's a big disparity across the board. It has nothing to do with Nash. This was before, you know, this happened, this hire happened. And so that's where the argument really goes. How do we increase opportunities for Black coaches in this league where it's 80% Black players. And, you know, what is the system? What is the structure? You know, what is the criteria for us to have these opportunities? And I always, the player I always look at is a guy like Sam Cassell, who I think has paid his dues, is a tremendous coach. He's very passionate, energetic. He was a hell of a player. And so he fits the bill on both ends. He could have been a guy that came right into coaching because of the success he had on the court. But he's also gone into coaching and done it the assistant route, and he's done it in two really high-profile situations in Washington, really mentoring a guy like John Wall, and now in L.A. And so when you see these hires, you go to the other side of the argument, which is how do the African Americans get more opportunities? And you think of a guy like Sam Cassell specifically, and as an example, because he's paid the dues on both ends.
Yeah. Does the this is a too complicated of a question to end on, but does the NBA need a Rooney Rule or something else? Is there something that they could institute?
Well, and it's frustrating. If you need the Rooney Rule, you're admitting that there's an issue, and if there's an issue, you know, what's the best way to address it? I don't know if the Rooney Rule is going to address it. You know, when I mentioned guys like Jamal Mosley and Dave Vanderpool, they've had a ton of opportunities or in terms of interview. You know, are these interviews legit? Are they hiring for the associate head coach spot, or, you know, are they legit candidates and not getting the job? You know, maybe we need to reevaluate that, but maybe there's a process where you when you interview, you know, you have to name your five candidates and you know, talk about, I don't know. I'm just throwing out some ideas, but, you know, obviously it's an issue with both NFL and NBA, and you're looking at a lot of guys that, you know, should have or could have opportunities that aren't getting it. And so you're trying to figure out, you know, what will position Black coaches down the line to get these jobs. Is there a way of doing it, and what is that way?
Single best piece of advice you could give Steve Nash on the way in?
The same advice he gave me when I got into coaching: just be yourself and people will respect you for that. That's exactly what he told me when I said, "Hey, Steve, guess what? I just got a job in Cleveland." And he said, "That's great. Just be yourself." He said, people respect you just by being you. And so I think I don't have to tell him that, but I think he knows in this league, credibility, relationships are important. And he's the utmost and has the utmost respect and admiration from our players. So just be himself.
Seemed to work out okay for you, that advice. So,
yeah.
Lloyd, this has been great, man. I appreciate it. So much else I would love to talk to you about, including your piece on John Lewis that was in the Players Tribune a couple months back. People should go check that out. We'll save that discussion for next time. Always good to visit with you, my man. Appreciate it.
You got it. All right, H.
All right, man. Take care.
Talk soon.